who want to listen to this session, sit down. And people who don't, leave. Though I hesitate to say that. I wondered when I saw what the venue for this meeting was, that perhaps we were being a little bit optimistic about America's interest in the future of Europe. And I think I might have been right about that. But it's everybody else's loss, because we're going to have a very interesting discussion. Let me first of all introduce the members of this panel. On my immediate left is Barry Eichengreen, who is a professor of economics and a professor of political science at Berkeley. He is also, and not just in my opinion, one of the world's top two or three economic historians, and quite separately from that, one of the world's top two or three finance scholars. He really is a remarkable man, and it just so happens he's recently published An Economic History of Europe Since 1945. I believe that copies are available in the bookshop, and all of you are here because you have some interest in the future of Europe. Do yourself a favor, and if you haven't bought that book, buy it after this session. It's absolutely outstanding. Our next panelist is Princess Mabel, who's a senior official. I don't know if you're quite running it, Mabel, or whether you're one of the top officers, but of the Open Society Institute in London. This is a George Soros-financed enterprise which collects together, organizes networks of activists for human rights around the world, and especially in Eastern Europe. And Mabel has also just recently embarked on an exercise to create a European Council on Foreign Relations. And finally, we have John Bruton, who is currently the European Union's ambassador to the United States. In addition, as I expect you know, John is a former prime minister of Ireland. And maybe you also know that at the moment, actually for the past 20 years, Ireland has been the miracle economy of Western Europe. It's moved in that span of time from being one of Europe's poorest economies to being the richest in per capita terms. The only richer one is Luxembourg, which isn't really a country at all. John. John is deeply implicated in that success, and it really is an honor to have him with us today on this panel. I'm going to kick off this discussion very briefly, and we'll try and keep the conversation up here on the panel for a little while, but I want to alert you to the fact that there's a microphone here, and after maybe 20 minutes or half an hour, I'll remind people that if they would like to ask a question or make a comment, they should go to the microphone. Then I will keep going unless I see that someone's standing there waiting to make an intervention, and then I will invite them to do so. One more housekeeping point. Some of my fellow moderators at this event insist on questions only. I apply no such prohibition. We're interested in comments as well as questions, comments for the panel to react to, but I would only ask that you keep them brief. It doesn't have to be a question, but keep it brief. Okay. The future of Europe. The State of the Union is not strong. I'm talking about the European Union, or so it seems to me. For years now, the European economy as a whole has underperformed the American economy, falling further and further behind in growth and productivity. America has had a productivity miracle in recent years. Maybe there are signs that the steam is going out of it a little bit right now, but that miracle largely, it seems to me, passed Europe by. Why was that? Politics, too, does not look so good in the European Union at the moment. Those of you who follow the news on this will know that quite recently the European Union failed to produce a new draft constitution. Well, I should say it produced a draft constitution but then failed to get the countries of Europe to agree to it. It was put to a referendum in a variety of countries, and France and the Netherlands, to the surprise of many people, rejected it. Just in the past few weeks, the effort to revive this constitution writing exercise ended in what I regard as a rather squalid unsatisfactory compromise. But I'll let the panel say more about that and challenge them if they disagree with that assessment. But my view is that this effort to write a new constitution for the European Union has failed in a very damaging way. And there is a lack of momentum, it seems to me, now in the whole project, a widening distance between Europe's people and Europe's leaders. Americans who read about Europe in the press might be most familiar with a criticism or an issue that many Europeans, well, I wonder if they're so concerned about it. I've lost track of the number of articles I've read in the US about the Muslim takeover of Europe. Now, there is an issue, I don't need to tell you, in the wake of these bombings in Britain just the other week. There is an issue with Islamic terrorism in Europe. But quite a few commentators in the US seem to be writing off the whole European Union as lost to Islam. That does seem to me an extraordinarily alarmist point of view. But there is a germ of truth in it, which is that Europe's populations are falling, with the single exception of very rapidly rising Muslim population. I'd like to know what the panel think about that. Where do these trends lead? How optimistic or pessimistic should we be about the future of Europe, about the future of the Union? I just want to start by putting that question to each member of the panel to elicit some initial comments, and then we'll take it from there. So Barry, do you want to start?
Sure. I'm more optimistic than Clive is, which probably isn't difficult. let me start by saying it's nice to be here and to be part of this panel on Europe. One can't help but notice that there are panels on Asia outnumber panels on Europe by, what, a factor of six?
Yes.
At this conference. I think panels on Web 2.0 outnumber panels on Europe, even. The only solace is that we're not Latin Americanists. We would feel really left out. It's important to remember what the largest economy in the world measured by aggregate GDP is. It's the European Union. And for an economist, certainly, you can't talk about the future of the global economy without thinking hard about European prospects. So how is Europe doing economically? Commentators tend to answer to paint the picture in either in black or white, and I think we've seen the dark-hued version of it just now. So either Europe is economically moribund, it's a big theme park with castles and beaches and not a whole lot else, or really it's better than the United States and will remain better than the United States at doing a number of important things. It's better at incremental innovation. We do radical innovation for a variety of well-known reasons in the US, but in terms of learning how to do established manufacturing processes, for example, a little better, Europe has a lot going for it. Europe is better than we are in the US at balancing labor and leisure. Europe is better, I think, at reconciling efficiency with equity. So those are the black and the white. I'm a shades of gray person. I think Europe is actually doing quite well at the moment and will continue doing reasonably well in the short run. It's growing faster than the United States at the moment. It does better than we do at precision manufacturing because of its training and apprenticeship and other institutional arrangements. I think there is room in the world economy for both models, for both styles of economic organization, the European model and the US model. At the same time, I worry, like our moderator does, about the longer run. There is the demographic problem. Everybody talks about that. But more than aging, I would worry about Asia. I think Italy has already had its lunch eaten by the Chinese, who are figuring out how to move up market and to produce the kind of consumer goods that the Italians have long had a niche in. What are they going to move up market in next? They're going to move up market in the production of producer goods. Mm-hmm. So all those middle-sized German firms that make and export machine tools around the world, their challenge is going to come from much lower wage economies in Asia. And it's not clear to me yet that they have an answer. So the answer, if there is one, takes the form of economic reform, and that'll bring me to the European Union in one moment. These European economies need to build service sectors. I think it's fair to say that in significant parts of Europe, Germany, for example, being a worker in the service sector is not viewed exactly as a high prestige occupation. Providing services for someone else is not the same kind of honest job that working in manufacturing long has been. Europe needs to build a service sector and to deploy information technology in the way we have in the United States to raise productivity in that part of its economy. It needs to develop the capacity to innovate more radically, which will involve venture capital and closer university business ties and a variety of other well-known things that Europe doesn't have. It needs to update the European model for the 21st century, and that finally brings me to the EU. I think the approach to that problem has been, since 2000 or so, to try to use the European Union as the device for pushing forward the reformist agenda in Europe, the Lisbon agenda to make Europe the most competitive economy in the world by 2010. That's a European Union, a European Commission-led initiative. I think that's the wrong way to go about the reform process. Hmm. If there's going to be meaningful economic reform in Europe, it's going to have to be done at the national level. It's going to be done by Mr. Sarkozy, and we're going to have some discussion, I'm sure, about what he means when he says economic reform and whether he is, quote, serious about it. In Germany, it was started by Mr. Schroeder, and if it's going to happen, it'll have to be finished by Mrs. Merkel. National models differ. National reform needs differ. The European Union can't do it. And most importantly, I think you need ownership over the reform process. You need a political consensus at the national level to make it happen. So I worry that having the EU in the vanguard of the reform process has been a mistake. And I worry that the treaty agreed to a few weeks ago doesn't really resolve that issue. It doesn't clearly explain what the responsibilities of the EU should be, what the responsibilities of the nation states, which are not going to go away in Europe, should be. Having said all that, I think there is a sense that the current angst about Europe and about the EU is overdrawn. They're here to stay, and even the recent treaty is very much a work in progress.
Okay. Thank you for that. I can't help, before I ask Mabel to speak, I can't help but note the term. I'm far more of a Eurosceptic than you are, but I would make one exception, and that would be to disagree with you about the role of the Commission in driving reform. I think the best case you could make myself for the European Union is the way that economic reform has been driven forward across Europe, in ways that wouldn't otherwise have happened. But anyway, we can engage with that in a moment. Mabel, what's your sort of high-level take on how optimistic are you about Europe's future? How pessimistic? What are the issues at the front of your mind when that question's raised?
Well, it's a mixed bag, and I think we need to take a step back before we judge. If you think about Europe as a continent, 65 years ago, we were pretty much killing each other. We were in war. Only 20 years ago, the continent was divided. You had, the free world and the communism. And we now have a union of 27 member states, 12 of them former communist countries, who are trying to jointly work on economic welfare. It's a democratic union, the largest democratic union in the world. And I think that is pretty impressive. So there are a lot of troubles there. We're going to be talking about them. But I think we should not forget the big picture, that it is quite amazing what we have achieved so far. Now, aren't there problems? Yes, there are a lot of problems, I think, in Europe. I think one of them is related to the integration of our minorities. We had a culture of hope. And we're turning into a culture of fear in Europe in a way. There's xenophobia, there are anti-Muslim sentiments, even though these citizens play a crucial part in our economy. And I think we have to learn to live with the challenges of integration. I mean, we hear only about the problems, but the problems are made by a very small percentage of the population. and all the other Muslims and other minorities in our countries that we invited in 10, 20, 30 years ago, they're actually very, very helpful. So I think that's an area where we have to look. A big challenge, which I don't want to elaborate on so much, is the issue of our economy. The world is changing. We all know China, India, new economic superpowers coming up. And we'll have to confront that. We're not going to be able to survive, I think, economically in this world by kind of boxing ourselves in, protecting our market, looking, you know, navel glazing and not doing the necessary reforms. And that's going to require a lot of courage of our governments, but we'll have to do that. And that's going to be a big challenge. And thirdly, I think that we have to kind of stop being obsessed with our own divisions and weaknesses. You always hear about how we disagree, but we should look at what we have as a European Union. We give more than half of the overseas development assistance globally. A lot more than the United States of America on a per capita basis. We're the biggest single market in the world. We have 45,000 diplomats who can do all kind of good work. We have two permanent seats in the Security Council. We have more than 100,000 peacekeepers deployed across all continents. You know, we have aid, trade, and the perspective membership to offer to other countries. And I think what we need to do in Europe is try to make sure that we stop punching below our weight, but use all these beautiful assets that we have in a much more constructive way to be a force for global good.
Okay. Thank you. John.
I think the big miracle of the European Union in the last number of years has been the enlargement of the Union. When you think that we have gone from 10 to 15 members to 25 and now to 27 members, at every stage with the unanimous agreement of all of the existing members. And at each stage, in almost every case, it was a case of richer countries agreeing to share their market with poorer countries, which meant competition to drive down wages in the richer countries, which meant money being transferred through the EU budget from the richer countries to the poorer countries. And at every stage, we've gone through successive enlargements. What we've done since 2003 is equivalent in population terms to the United States and Mexico merging the 50 states of the US with the 32 states of Mexico and creating a single labor market where Mexicans were free to work anywhere in Europe, anywhere in North America. That's what we've done. We've actually done that. Now, it's not fully actualized in every case yet, but it is going to happen by 2011. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's an enormous political thing to have done. And you're probably right to criticize us for saying that we haven't done a whole lot of other things at the same time. But that in itself required such an effort. I mean, these things don't, they're not easy to do. And they involve sacrifice. And I think it's a really big thing. And in doing it, we've sort of underpinned the court system in those countries. We've underpinned respect for property rights. We've underpinned all sorts of predictability factors that are important for investment. And this has been an enormous benefit to the United States. I am quite sure that a lot of the American firms that are investing in Poland, that are investing in Hungary, that are investing in Romania today, would not be doing it if those countries weren't in the European Union. Because by virtue of these countries being in the European Union, the American companies know now that they have all these guarantees that their money is safe. But without the European Union, it wouldn't have happened. Now, so the enlargement of the European Union is beneficial to the United States and it's beneficial to the countries concerned. And it has led to a certain, I suppose, future shock on the part of perhaps the electors in the Netherlands and the electors in France who voted against the constitution, because things seem to be happening so fast that people couldn't catch up with them. And I think that seems to be one of the reasons why there have been some faltering steps on some issues. I would agree that there are things that we need to do in the economic area, although, as Barry pointed out, our economy is actually going faster than the American economy just at the moment.
Right now, yeah.
Yes, and I'm not going to make a big deal of that, because for the reasons that Barry gave, because we're in fields which are vulnerable. Our strength is in fields that are potentially quite vulnerable. Maybe not in the immediate future, but in the next after that. And we do have a demographic problem. We have a social security problem. We have a health problem in terms of the demographics. but at least we're facing up to it. In every European country, something is being done about both of those problems. Social security reform is being tackled. The pension age has been raised in Germany. It has been raised in France. It's been raised in virtually every country. Our healthcare entitlements have been cut back in order to be more compatible with our demography. Now, of course we should have done it long ago, but we're doing it now.
Right.
There's another big country where that has yet to happen.
Right.
And admittedly, in that big country, the problem is less than the problem is in Europe. I admit that. But at the same time, it's a pretty big problem here,
right,
too.
Sure.
So I think, you know, give us a bit of credit for that. On Barry's point about whether the European Union should be leading this reform agenda, in reality, as he knows, all that the European Union is doing is exercising peer pressure on the members. We're producing reports on what they're doing. But we acknowledge that in virtually all of the areas of reform that are required, social security, health, pension age, liberalising markets and all that, in virtually all of the areas, it's a matter for the member states themselves. So it's peer pressure. That's all we're exercising. There are two or three areas where we have taken some action ourselves. Liberalising services. After a long gestation, we've produced a free market in services of a sort. I don't know how well that's going to work, but at least we've got something on the statute book after a long delay. And financial services reform has been pushed very hard and with some success and has brought tremendous benefits, I think, to London in particular by the liberalisation of financial services in Europe. And I think that's going to lower the cost of capital in Europe and it is going to ultimately to lead to more economic efficiencies and a more active venture capital market. But there are lots of things to do. Last point I want to make. You could look at the fact that Europeans, you know, work shorter lives, shorter weeks, and shorter days. You could look at that as a shocking problem. You could say, you know, the Europeans are choosing leisure. But you could also look at it from the other way and say, well, look, if the Europeans have to work harder, well, they do have the days, the hours, and the years in which to do it. They can raise the pension age. They can raise the working age, they can lengthen the working week, so we have that in reserve, so to speak. In this country, you work
There's
so
no reserve,
hard.
Yeah.
You work so hard in this country. I mean, you are a wonderfully hard-working country, but I would suggest that physically, you probably, you know, it's not much possible for you to work much harder than you're already working. We have this, I won't say by design, we have the built-in sort of built-in escape route that we have by not working as hard in the past.
I did want to come back on this point. Actually, I was going to raise it just because Barry did on this business of work-life balance. You know, I did want to go on record as saying this is something I think Europe has got right. You know, as a European who's moved to the US, I am dismayed by this country's, you know, relentless obsession with work, with hours in the office, and with a lack of a life outside work. I mean, maybe this isn't the venue to be making that observation, but by and large, it's true. I think, of course, it's a deep question, why is that? But there's no doubt in my mind that Europe has got that right and America has not, so I agree with you. But let me put another question to you, which really follows up on something that John said about enlargement. I'm a huge fan, myself, of enlargement, but it raises an issue. To do with European identity. I think you could argue, I'm putting this theory to you, I think you could argue that at various points in the recent past, Europe has had a kind of strategic choice to make about whether it broadens the union or deepens the union. And the argument goes like this. If you want to broaden the union, you bring in Eastern Europe, you bring in countries which are very different in many ways, culturally and politically, from Western Europe, and you make, as it were, relatively small demands on the way they change, the way their countries are run in order to bring them into the European Union. That's broadening, as it were, shallow broadening. The alternative is to say there's a core of countries where the sense of European identity, Western European identity, is strong. Those countries want to move rapidly forward towards a tighter political integration. So you call that deepening. And the theory I'm putting to the panel is that there was a choice to be made between those two things. Either of them might have worked. But what Europe has tried to do is both. Simultaneously, Europe has tried to broaden amazingly, just as John says, I mean, the achievement is staggering in terms of the countries that have joined and the differences, you know, the extent of the change is remarkable. But at the same time, the union has been driving forward on this agenda of political integration. There's been a movement towards surrendering the national veto and the adoption of a principle called qualified majority voting, which basically means that if you're in the union and a sufficient majority of countries votes to do something at the level of the union, one country cannot stop that, or even a small number of countries cannot stop that. They have to go along with it. Now, that is a very severe surrender of national sovereignty, and I think that's a problem. I would have been for enlargement, as it were, a broad and shallow union, but I'm putting it to you that it's a mistake to have gone for a broad and deep union, and the resistance that you're seeing from European electorates, starting with the rejection of the Constitution, is reflecting that unease with simultaneously bringing in so many very different countries and forming a tightly integrated political unit. Well, I'd like to hear from each of you on this. What do you think, Barry?
Well, I think it's clear that Europe has reached the point of no return where it can't continue with the kind of deepening initiatives that characterized the European Union through the mid-1990s. What, at the end of 1994, there were 12 EU member states. Now they're 27. And it's clear they have very different ideas of what Europe means. And they're not going to allow themselves to be pulled along by qualified majority voting into a deeper Europe than they prefer. So say what you will about Polish diplomacy at the recent right. summit, the new European members are going to resist the implementation of an idea of Europe that doesn't resonate with their own histories in the second half of the 20th century. So I think, you know, variable geometry has always been on the table. That's European code for different clubs that agree to different kinds of initiatives. So there's a subset of EU member states that have adopted the euro. And there's another subset that's adopted the Schengen agreement of no passport checks at the border, and we're going to see more of that. So I, you know, Clive appreciates the irony of somebody from the UK, which has opt-outs on a number of these agreements, arguing that there is this fundamental opposition between deepening and broadening. I think Europe will figure out how to reconcile them.
Before I ask you, Mabel, to comment, let me just, do people understand the reference that Barry just made to Poland's negotiating tactics? For those who don't, I think it was very interesting. There was a row in the negotiations over the treaty about voting power. And voting power is related in a complicated formula to various things, and one of the things is population. And the Poles pointed out in the course of this negotiation that their population and therefore their voting power would have been a lot bigger if it hadn't been for the actions of a previous German government. So that gives you some sense of strength of feeling in Poland on that issue. But one other thing, Barry, before we move on to Mary, I just wanted to question the notion that, you know, the sort of high watermark has been reached and we go no further. The new reform treaty has extensions of qualified majority voting in it and in very important areas. This new treaty is a big further step in the direction of political deepening. People don't want it, but it's there in the treaty. Mabel.
Before I respond to the broader comment, you suggested that when there was a referendum in France and the Netherlands about whether we liked the constitution or not, that it was rejected, at least largely because of a fear of further enlargement. And I don't think that's fair. From what I understand...
Actually, I didn't say that.
Well, it's been suggested by a lot of people, and you know, that there's a huge fear among populations about enlargement. And I think what people find much more frustrating and what the rejection of that constitution meant was, on the one end, a vote of discontent with the governments at that time in the Netherlands, in France, in general. But it was also because people are frustrated that the European Union works in a very untransparent way, for example. the Council of Minister meetings, they're not open. We don't know what really happens. So for an activist like me, if you want to know who was taking what position on, let's say, human rights abuses in an African country, you spend hours on the phone trying to understand who said what, rather than that you can see it. And there were a lot of other reasons. So the suggestion that the people of Europe don't want further enlargement, you know, there's more to the fact that that the constitution was rejected in the Netherlands and in France. Now, to go to the other point, I want to take a broader look, a longer-term look, about whether we should work more intensively together or not. And again, that has to do with globalization. It has to do with the emergence of new economic superpowers. It has to do with the changed role of America in the world, which is not longer like the sole leader that we in Europe work closely with. It has to do with the fact that in Russia, we have a newly shaping regime that might not be as democratic as we had envisioned it to be. And you know, in the long term, as somebody put it, the question is, does Europe want to basically be condemned to the faith of Venice and become a big open-air museum? You know, people will forget that there are countries like Luxembourg. Or do we unite and do we work together? And yes, that's going to be a very painful process if you have 27 countries which each have, you know, their own individuals and their own policies and their own histories. But only if we work together, I think that we can then survive in this globalizing world as a force for good that I was referring to earlier, but also as an economic powerhouse that we want to be. So I don't think we really have a choice. You know, in Europe, we'll have to work together. And it's going to be painful, but it will also ultimately be to the benefit of all us European citizens.
Clive, you're very kindly referenced Ireland's success as an economy, as a member of the European Union. And I can say with absolute certainty we would not have been the success we were if we weren't in the European Union. And we would not have been in the success we were if it wasn't for the single market, whereby we were free, and American companies in particular were free, to export at that time to all 15 member states. They wouldn't have located in Ireland without that being absolutely guaranteed. And that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for qualified majority voting. If you had to get all 15 members to agree, you would have had one or two countries saying, oh, we couldn't possibly agree to this regulation to restrict state subsidies or to restrict state-supported monopolies in a particular market, and it wouldn't have happened. By having qualified majority voting, we got rid of the monopolies. We opened up the markets, and we attracted the American investment. Qualified majority voting does diminish sovereignty, but it's an entirely appropriate diminution of sovereignty. As Peter Mandelson put it in his recent article, what happens is that by pooling sovereignty, countries multiply their sovereignty. They actually increase the scale of their influence by teaming together with other countries. By acting individually, they have much less control on what happens. Take the case of Switzerland and Norway. They are not members of the European Union, but they have to implement large swathes of EU legislation in which they have no input at all, because they want access to the European market. If you're in the European Union, you do lose some sovereignty, but at least you have a vote in there on these things. It's better to be on the inside with some influence than entirely sovereign on the outside with no influence on things that are going to affect you anyway. And that's, I think, that's the actual choice we face in the modern world. I mean, the notions of sovereignty that are promulgated in some countries are ones which have more of a 19th century than a 21st century reference, in my view.
As to when you say some countries, are you thinking of the US?
No. I won't go any further than that. You've already put me so close to losing my job on several occasions. I think I'll be prudent for once in my life. But I think as well, just to come to this reform treaty that was a constitution, I think it's important that the audience should know that it is going to do a number of things that will be quite useful. One, any new EU legislation that's proposed by the Commission will have to be considered before it goes to the European Parliament and before it goes to the Council of Ministers, which are our House of Representatives and the Senate, so to speak, at European level, will have now to be considered by each of the 27 member state parliaments. And they will say, do they think that this is something that the EU should be dealing with, or is it something that could be better dealt with at national level? So you're going to have a check on excessive centralisation. And you're going to involve the democratic representatives elected at each member state in that decision. And that's going to identify the citizens of the Netherlands through their parliament more with the European Union than is currently the case. You're going to have a single foreign minister. You're going to have qualified majority voting, that thing that Clive isn't too keen on justice and home affairs matters.
Right now.
In other words, there won't be a common market for criminals at the moment. You have a common market for legitimate business, which we've created, which gives freedom to criminals, but we don't have a single legal area. We don't have a single approach to sharing intelligence, to collecting evidence, to arresting people, and to ensuring that the criminals who might exploit cross-border situations to their advantage are brought to justice in an efficient way. And we are, by virtue of this constitution, going to ensure that the common market doesn't become a common market for criminals, okay, that there is a common approach to crime.
I'm having to restrain myself here. I mean, but
please don't.
No, I want to have a comments, have the audience feel that comments and questions are encouraged, and indeed they are encouraged. So, what's your point?
My name is Sam Brown, and as one American who shares the view that a strong European Union is good not only for Europe, but good for the United States, fundamentally good for the United States, but we have also had another very strong ally in the region over the last 50 or 60 years that has gone through enormous turmoil to remain our ally, and I would be interested in your comments European.
Who would like to take that one?
I would be delighted.
Let's go.
I mean, I'm a big supporter of the idea that that Turkey should join the European Union once it's ready for membership. And what I find very disturbing that there is right now a debate in Europe about should Turkey be a member, yes or no. We decided already years and years and years ago that Turkey could be a member of the European Union. And I don't think we can change our mind about it now. Now, whether ultimately they're fit to become a member, we will only know once they have done a long process of membership negotiations, which took, in the case of the countries in Central and Eastern Europe, about 10 to 15 years. And so the fact that there are now certain politicians who are saying, let's decide today whether Turkey can be a member, yes or no, I think it's not appropriate. That decision should be made in 10 or 15 years by those people who are ruling Turkey and the EU member states and possibly the European population then. The situation will be completely different. I mean, Turkey is growing at a rate of almost 10% per year economically. It will be a different country. Europe will be different. The European Union will be a different place at that time. And I could very well imagine that for geopolitical reasons, it's going to be great to have Turkey in the Union because it means that we have an ally, you know, that is bordering a part of the world where there are a lot of problems. Turkey might help us deal with some of our aging problems, you know, our demographic problems, because actually we're going to have to bring in 1.5 million immigrants per year if we want to keep our workforce on an equal level. And, you know, if we can bring them in from Turkey, that would be great. Otherwise, they have to come from much farther away and it might be much harder to integrate these people. I think economically it will be very good. There's a whole other range of reasons why I personally think it's a good thing, but I don't think we should decide it today. A process has started, and once we've finalized these negotiations in 10 or 15 years, let's then decide whether we still want Turkey, but also does Turkey then still want to be part of the European Union? Who knows? Maybe they don't want us at that time any longer.
Barry, you had a comment on this.
What's really disturbing about the current discussion in Europe about Turkey is that Europe has a set of rules and procedures that determine whether a country like Turkey qualifies for membership. At a summit in Copenhagen, there was a list developed, the Copenhagen criteria of 80 plus rules pertaining to human rights and women's rights and economic reform and so forth. that a country has to satisfy in order to qualify for membership. There's the acquis, the set of European laws and procedures that a country has to be prepared to adopt. And that's a rational, transparent, above board way of judging whether a country qualifies or not. And one I perceive in the current European discussion that now there's an undertone of whether Turkey is really European, and it has a religious dimension to it. That's a step backward from how the issue of Turkish membership was discussed previously. One final comment, I make that point in Europe, and my European friends say, very easy for you to say, and we understand the geopolitical advantages of having Turkey in the EU too, but think about how difficult it would be for you to take in such a very large, very poor entity as the 51st state. It looks different from Aspen than it would look from Berlin.
And Muslim, let's not forget that. I mean, I think that is the big worry in the minds of most people. Before I ask John to comment, let me just respond as well, if I may. I agree with you. My view has long been that Turkey should come into the EU. But I go back to the point I raised before about broadening and deepening. What makes it difficult to bring Turkey in is that bringing Turkey in is a much, much bigger deal than it would have been if Europe had been content with a shallower form of union. You are bringing Turkey into an emerging United States of Europe, and that's an entirely different proposition. And I was also struck by the way you said, in due course we'll decide. Now is not the time. In due course, let the rulers of Europe decide, and possibly the people too. Only possibly the people. Can you imagine, for instance, the United States forming a political union with Mexico, with a settled majority of Americans against that decision, and just going ahead anyway and saying, well, we will decide, and you will get to like it? Isn't that the problem?
Well, so far, each country that joined the Union, there has not been a referendum whether they could join. If the decision is from now onwards to have referenda, then that is a political decision, but that should then not only apply to Turkey, that should also apply to the other candidate
countries.
The question whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, that is a question about to which extent you want to involve a population through referenda in political decisions. And that's a subject that, you know, I think we should organize a different session on, because that brings up a whole lot of other issues.
In my view, this is at the core of the whole issue. The distance of Europe's leaders from its people.
I think the reality of the matter is that if you had had to have a referendum in the original six members to form the European Union, and you had to have agreement in each of them, you wouldn't have had a European Union. I think if in 1787 you'd had a referendum in each of the states that formed the United States with all the people voting, you wouldn't have formed the United States of America either. The reality of it is that some things happen as a result of leadership, which is judged after the event by its effects rather than before the event on the basis of promises that are uncertain anyway. And I think there is a place for parliamentary government. And I come from a country, as you do, which says that important decisions should be made in parliament, not by plebiscites, and which was very critical in 1922, for example, of the use of plebiscites in Italy and to mandate the government of Signor Mussolini. And I think the plebiscites, I don't enthrone them as the ultimate representation of democracy. I also would have to take issue, Clive, with the assumption that you make that somehow or other we had a choice in the last few years to decide to go for a shallow union and a wide, shallow union. Well, I happen to have read the Treaty of Rome, which was agreed 50 years ago. And in the first line of that, it says, the aim is an ever closer union of the peoples of Europe.
Yes.
Not of the sovereign states of Europe, of the peoples of Europe. And that's the union that every country that has joined the European Union since signed up to voluntarily.
Right.
In the case of Britain, they actually joined twice. Because under the Conservatives, they joined and accepted the treaty, which included ever closer union as one of its objectives. And then Harold Wilson came in and he said, well, I think we should ask the people. So they had a second decision to stay in the European Union. And I think if you join a club on the basis of a set of rules that everyone else has accepted, which include ever closer union, you should accept that you've given an undertaking. You can, of course, can withdraw from the European Union if that's what your wish is, but you shouldn't sort of undermine the fundamental founding principle, which was that this is a body set up to create an ever closer union of the peoples of Europe. It never was. The European Union never was a simply economic project. The European Union always was harnessing economic self-interest to achieve a greater political goal. And that goal was bringing Europeans so close together emotionally that they would never go to war again with one another. That's what it was from the beginning. Countries were free never to join. There was such a thing called the European Free Trade Association, which, if there were countries who wanted, you know, a wide and shallow union, that was the place for them to have gone.
Right.
And it still exists. I think there's Liechtenstein and Iceland, right, and I think one other country I remember of that. And, you know, countries that want that sort of union, that's the place for them. But the European Union is based on an ever closer union of the peoples of Europe as its key objective. Now, the question of Turkey. First of all, every member state must agree for any new member to come in. In the case of France, they, unfortunately, in my view, have amended their constitution to provide that in the case of any additions after Croatia, and this will include Montenegro and Serbia and other countries if they come to be ready to join, as well as Turkey, that in the case of those countries, the French people will be consulted.
You think that's a mistake? For the reasons you just said.
I think it's a mistake. I think it was done for reasons in order to get the constitution passed, and it didn't succeed in doing that. It was to reassure French people about the constitution, which in fact had nothing to do with Turkey, but Turkey was raised, as they always are in plebiscites, issues that are not related to the proposition are raised in plebiscites, and that's the problem with plebiscites. But
right,
the French have amended their constitution. What do I think would happen? I think if we get a successful negotiation concluded with Turkey, I think it will probably be associated with a number of other Balkan countries coming in as well at that time. I don't know who they'll be. And this will be put to the French people, look, this is good for your security. Your security is at stake. You should vote for it to make France safe. And I'm not a betting man, but I think I would bet that France will vote yes at the end. I think it's regrettable that it's going to be such a cliffhanger, but I think they will vote yes at the end. It's a pity that it's in the situation we're in, but I think we will live up to our commitments. And as the princess said, we gave solemn commitments back in the 60s that Turkey was eventually going to be a candidate for membership of the European Union. And just as countries can't come along and say that they didn't read the Treaty of Rome when it said about ever closer union, we can't say that we didn't say to the Turks that you can come in back in the 60s and go back on that. I mean, the decisions of one generation do bind the next, and I think we've got to live up to our commitments. But it's going to be a hard struggle. It's going to be political, and there's going to have to be a lot of elbows used to get where we need to get.
Okay, well, that's nothing new anyway. Please, next question.
I'm a Fulbright scholar, just came back a year ago from a mission of a year and a half in the Balkans on behalf of the U.S. State Department. My question to you is as follows. One of the things that was totally unprepared for in the State Department and definitely did not prepare us for is the many anti-American sentiments we had to deal with as Fulbright scholars everywhere we went in Eastern Europe. With the enlargement of the European Union and the inclusion of many of these countries now and yet to come into the European Union, who have not had the kind of history of relationships with the United States, and the sentiment that I have faced, that I found out later talking to my colleagues, other Fulbright scholars, about people that not necessarily were, I would say, the non-intellectuals, but those in decision-making. What do you think is going to happen with the relationship of the United States with the enlarged Europe?
Which countries are you thinking of specifically? Because I'm a little surprised. You know, the polls tend to show more favorable opinion in New Europe, you know, in Eastern Europe, towards the U.S. than in Western Europe. So which countries are you talking about?
All the way from Macedonia, Serbia, Montenegro, Slovenia, Croatia, Romania, Bulgaria.
Okay. Mabel, perhaps you'd like to take that on.
Well, I guess there are two things that might explain this, but this is, you know, I personally don't share these sentiments, so I'm guessing what it could be. I think on the one hand, which is not a secret, we even had a panel about it last night, there is has been since 9/11 and since the war on terror started and you know, a different perception globally about the United States. There is very much a feeling out there that the US, which used to set the agenda for the world, is now following the wrong agenda and implementing it on top of that in the wrong way. And so I guess that people are frustrated about that, and that might explain part of it. I think also because a number or most of the countries, if not all that you mentioned, are countries from the Balkans. And I think something which would not be a justified sentiment in my view, but what might explain it is that the US did incredibly important work in the Balkans. If it wasn't for the US, the war in Bosnia might not have finished in 1995. We might not have had a Dayton agreement, etc. And at some point, the US got less involved in the Balkans. And the EU, unfortunately, I think, tried to fill that gap, but didn't do a good enough job. And so the situation in the Balkans, even though the wars have ended quite a while ago, is still quite messy. And I wouldn't be surprised that people are slightly frustrated that the US isn't any longer there to help to sort the problems there. Now, I think these problems are primarily for the people living in that part of the world to solve themselves. But yes, it is in a way not very fortunate that the US and the EU are not more actively helping to bring prosperity to that part of the world.
With the inclusion of many of these countries in the next, starting now, and in the next 10 years within the European Union, do you think that there's going to be some measure of influence or shift as a result of their perception that is going to touch upon the relation between the United States and the European Union?
I think those perceptions of the United States change quite quickly depending on how that country feels its interests are being treated by the United States at a particular time. Some of the countries you mentioned probably weren't entirely happy with the war against Serbia. They might have had some sympathies with the Serbs, some of them, and that could explain it. I think a lot of people outside the United States also would like to have a vote in the US presidential election every 4 years. And if they're not happy with something that's being done, any American that comes into view gets the benefit of their sort of the vote that they would like to have cast, but didn't get a chance to do. And it's an unfortunate thing that, you know, you were sort of in the wrong place at the right time from their point of view. But I wouldn't think it's very deep-seated, really. And I think the European Union, as an entity, is, I believe, never more closely linked to the United States in the agenda that it's following than it is today. President Bush, in his second term, has reached out to the European Union in a way that no previous president has done, actually. And while that hasn't changed public opinion in Europe, it has meant that, you know, at the level of coordinating our policy on the Middle East, coordinating our policy on a whole range of issues, the European Union is working more closely with the United States now than it ever was before. And that is going to percolate down into public opinion eventually in Europe. But I think it's going to take time. You've got to be patient. I think the United States has also got to recognize that there are costs associated with just doing things unilaterally.
I think the only basis on which we have to speculate about the answer is, as Clive said, what happened in the new Central and Eastern European members after 2004. Membership in the EU did not obviously make them anti-American or make them say, aha, now we're a part of a big foreign policy apparatus, and we can start balancing against the United States. I think quite to the contrary.
We'll take the next comment or question, please.
Director of the German-based Greek Foundation. I would like to come back to the...
Maybe you could stand a little closer to the mic. We can't hear you.
I would like to come back to the discussion, too, because I think it's quite telling about the political mood in Europe and what the European Union is about. Three quick remarks. Mrs. Marble from Orania said, we should stick to the promises and commitments the European government says we need to do. I agree, but it's quite important that the European governments didn't succeed in convincing the majority of the European people, of the European public. And the accession of Turkey still is an elitist project. And the way it is discussed, you know, it's a very rationalistic one, and I agree with that. I agree especially with the geopolitical argument. And that's because I'm in favor for the accession of Turkey. But when Barry Eichengreen said, what's the fuss about that? The European Union is about a set of rules and standards, and we should just follow these rules if it comes to the decision on Turkey. I guess we all know very well that a political community is not only about a set of rules and standards. It's about a set of values, and it's about a common narrative, which creates a political community. And there are strong differences and reservations against Turkey of historical reasons, of cultural reasons, not only of religious reasons, also because of reasons of political culture with Turkey with its very strong Kemalist tradition. And Kemalism means nationalism, centralism, and a very autocratic regime.
So I'm sorry, I don't want to be rude, but okay. I did ask people to be brief. The panel has already offered a view on Turkey, unless you have anything else to say. I want to move on to another subject.
Okay.
And perhaps the lady behind you could ask the next question, make a comment. Thank you very much.
Mine is brief, thank you. So it's 50 years from now, what will the European Union really look like, A, and B, what implications will it have for potentially the formation of other unions? For example, a United States of the Americas or a United States of Southeast Asia?
That's a great question. Barry, do you have a view about that?
Well, I think the second part is easier to address than the first. I don't think Europe's model is exportable. John indicated why. It's a political project of a sort that can't be replicated in North America, in Latin America, in East Asia. There is no appetite for political integration, for sharing or pooling sovereignty in the European fashion in these other parts of the world.
Can I disagree?
Well, let me just give an example and then I'll stop. Mexicans, Great. You know, given their history with the United States, are deeply nationalistic. Our Mexican friends wouldn't want it. They wouldn't want a North American Union.
What about our British friends in Europe?
No, but I do think it's fair to say that what's happening right now in Africa with the creation of the African Union, I don't think that in any way it will be as intensive as the European Union is right now. But that is a model that very much is aspiring to work more intensively together. And if the Africans can get the African Union to work a little bit better and, you know, in the process of creating it, it could be to the benefit of everybody who lives in Africa.
Hmm.
I don't think you can export the European Union model whole to any other part, but there are parts of the European technique that can be used in other situations. One, the European Commission, which is intended to be a body that is pan-European, that tries to find the European interest rather than the sum of all the national interests. I think giving such a body the right of monopoly in the matter of proposing legislation is something that's a very good thing. I don't think the European Union would have got as far as it had if we simply didn't have the European Commission. I think the primacy of EU law in areas of competence of the EU is important for ensuring that there is uniform application of the laws across all of the European Union territory. I think that the idea of a directly elected parliament, directly elected, is also something very important because it gives people a direct stake, insufficient in my view, but a direct stake in the European project. The European Union is in fact the only multinational democracy in the world because we have a European Parliament. There's no parliament of the World Health Organization or of NAFTA or anything like that.
But so what makes you say this splendid arrangement is not exportable? If it's so good, why not export it?
Because there will be specific African circumstances. Say in Mercosur, you could have a situation where one country is just so much bigger than the others that may pose a difficulty unless you enlarge to include all of South America or something like that. Huh. So I think there are issues. I do also think I would agree with the earlier questioner that Europe does need to have a common narrative, that having a sense of where we have come from together is important for keeping us together. Now, of course, it doesn't have to go back 500 years. It can go back just 2 years. I mean, if, for example, the European Union together in the next 5 years solves the energy problem. No, I'm not saying we will, but let's assume right. We did for some right. That will create a sense of common achievement that will cement us together for the next challenge.
Right.
So you're creating the common narrative all the time. But I do think, as the questioner said, that a common narrative is an important part of the glue.
Maybe we should find somebody to have a war against. That would really cement European feeling. I just wanted to remind you of the second part of the question, or was it even the first part? Where will the EU be in 50 years? Maybe, John, you could tell us what 50 years of further enlargement and ever closer union will produce.
I'll hazard a guess. I think there will be two unions in Europe. There will be the Russian Federation and its, whatever it encompasses, which may be larger than the present Russian Federation, and there will be the European Union. And then there will be probably countries like Switzerland that are quite happy not to join either of these, but and are happy with all the constraints that go with that, because they're making sufficient money to not to worry. And I think that will probably be what will happen. I don't think Russia will become the big question. I suppose is, will Russia become a member of the European Union? I don't think so. I think it is so big, so diverse, and it is a European Union in itself. It has many more nationalities apart from the Russian nationality within the Russian Federation, and I think that will probably remain of its own. Question will be, I think Ukraine is going to have a difficult choice to make. If you were to look in Western Ukraine, they certainly orientate themselves towards Poland, towards Vienna, and towards Budapest. Whereas if you go to southern and eastern Ukraine, they're much more oriented towards Moscow and Asia. So I don't know what this decision at the end of the day Ukraine will make. Any European who visits Ukraine has a very strong sense that this is a European country. I hope they find their way into the European Union, but I hope they find their way into the European Union on terms that Russia is happy with, because to live harmoniously with Russia.
What about North Africa?
No. I mean, North Africa isn't part of Europe. I mean, that would be inhibiting the creation of whatever unions they may wish to form in North Africa or in Africa generally.
Okay.
We're not going around picking little pieces. I mean, we did that in the 19th century, where we picked other parts of the globe and said, well, we'll take them and we'll take that. And
you were so
that
persuasive about...
That's over. European activity is over.
You don't consider that Ireland has been colonised by the European Union, do they?
No, but we did have an experience with another very important power at one point. But, but I think our feelings about that are ambivalent, because, in fact, some of the best British colonial administrators happen to have Irish names.
I will ask for yours in a second, Barry. I just wanted to, borders aside, what about the internal polity? Do you see nations fading?
No.
Do you see a United States of Europe emerging?
No, I think you're going to have multi-layered government, just as we have a multi-layered lives. I mean, we all have different affinities and affiliations. I think, you know, the European Union is going to remain an important part of people's lives. It's going to deliver an important range of services, maybe a different range of services, of governmental services, to the ones that are delivering today. Some of the powers that it has may, in fact, be delegated. Some new powers may be given to it. But it's a very important tool that we have, and we will keep, and we will use.
Okay.
But I don't think it will ever become static in the sense that we'll say that it's not going to change. I would also agree very much with the Princess that I think now is not the time to be having a debate about the ultimate borders of Europe. That sort of Cartesian debate, rationalist debate, I think has no purpose. We've settled that already by saying any European country is eligible to join. Turkey is joining, is eligible to join because Eastern Thrace is geographically part of Turkey and part of Europe. And the rest of Turkey therefore comes in thanks to Eastern Thrace.
Okay. Okay. Barry, I cut you off.
I just wanted to observe that the F word has finally been uttered, federation, in the context of Russia,
right?
But not in the context
right.
of EU. So I think the answer to your question 50 years from now revolves around how Europe goes about political integration between now and then. I think economists can sketch out how economic integration would deepen and proceed and unfold, but you need the political governance and the accountability for the people making the economic policy and the foreign policy and other domestic policies, and how Europe will reconcile its unwillingness to go in the federal direction, which is real, with the need for those governance mechanisms.
I think that will only happen as and when necessary. We will federalize to the extent that we need to, and no more. But I think we're going to increasingly find that we're going to need to federalize, but not out of some sort of abstract principle, but on the basis of good pragmatism.
Okay, well, we could go on that subject, but we'll take one more question, and then I think we have to wrap up.
Before I ask my question, I have found someone that's asked in the chamber simply.
Ah, the gentleman behind you there.
I'll be very quick. Thank you. I'm between assignments. My last assignment, I was former U.S. ambassador in Brussels, Belgium. And I want to talk about Ambassador Gruber's point about a lot of companies would not have gotten into investing into Europe had they not been in the EU. Is anyone afraid of killing the goose and laying the golden egg with the regulations? We laugh at the productivity, the labor situation. One of the biggest issues that we fought daily was pharmaceutical companies' reach regulation program. I had the perfume people come in to see me because they were toxic. Perfume is toxic. Ink is toxic. Coca-Cola is toxic. Is anybody worried about the overregulation from the European Commission and what they might do to your economy?
Thanks for the question.
The regulation on chemicals is proposed by the European Commission, but has been agreed by the directly elected European Parliament and has been agreed by the directly elected representatives of the member states in the European Council. And it is coming into effect this month. What this does is say there are dangerous chemicals in the environment. In this case of new chemicals, under existing law both here and in Europe, new chemicals have to be approved. But chemicals that have been in use for years, which have never been examined, are not examined. And you could continue on using some old and dangerous chemical, and would do so if you had to know that if you were to substitute perhaps a new and safer one, you'd have to get that approved under existing rules. So what we're now saying is that every chemical in use, whether new or old, has to be registered and information produced as to how it's being used and as to whether there are risks to people from the use of those chemicals. I think this is going to save an enormous amount of money in the health of Europeans in the future, where dangerous chemicals in the environment will be identified. I think it's going to save us an awful lot of litigation. At the moment, you know, there is the risk of somebody being injured by some chemical which has some effect on some particular person with some particular condition that nobody knew about, suing and huge damages being awarded. If, on the other hand, a company is able to show that it has complied with REACH and that it has registered this chemical and it has made this known to all the relevant authorities, that company will be in a much better position to resist that litigation than if this wasn't created. And I would predict that this particular regulation will in fact be imitated by the United States within the next 10 years, because it is actually protecting the public from a concern that is a real one. However, to your broader point, there is a consciousness in Europe that we do regulate too much and that we have made too many regulations in the past on fiddling little things that we didn't need to regulate. And there is a serious effort being made by President Barroso and his present European Commission to deregulate and to get rid of regulations. And commissioners are being more or less hauled over the coals every few months to account for the number of regulations that they have junked. So Ambassador Kologos's point, which I've no doubt he made at every opportunity when he was in Belgium, has in fact been well and truly heard. And we are acting on it, but I will stoutly defend the REACH directive.
I think we ought to finish there. Barry, I know you've got things to say on this subject, but we're already over time. I hope you're glad you came. Please join me in thanking our panel.